Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua, and my guest today is Joan Scott, whose work in gender and French history should be familiar to us all. Joan is here today to discuss her latest book titled On the Judgment of History, which is a compilation of a series of three lectures which she delivered in 2019 at Columbia University. Joan, you, of course, are a good fan of the podcast, and you're here with us just last year, in fact, so a very warm welcome back to New Books.
Thank you.
Well, you were on our podcast last July to talk about what was then your 2017 book, Sex and Secularism, which is a humongous topic in its own right. But the topic of this book, the nature of historical judgment and this age-old idea that history will somehow redeem us, is arguably an even broader topic and no doubt a very challenging endeavor. How did you come to decide on this topic for the lectures in this book?
Well, you know, I say that a little bit in the preface. In 2017, after the Charlottesville demonstrations, when we were all horrified by the sight of, well, many of us were horrified, the president wasn't, but by the sight of Nazis marching and Ku Klux Klan of torches, I said to myself, in the kind of, you know, the way when you're sort of thinking about something, I sort of said, exasperated to myself, whatever happened to the judgment of history? Thinking about the fact that, you know, once something like Nazism or even the Ku Klux Klan were declared somehow outside the pale of moral social behavior, they come back. Why is it? How did they come back? What is it? And then I thought to myself, you know, whatever happened to the judgment of history? I said to myself, well, Joan, do you really believe in the judgment of history? And I thought, no, I really, you know, in some ways I don't. I don't believe that history is going to inevitably redeem us, that the future is always going to be better than the past. But it became a subject of curiosity to me. You know, how has the notion of the judgment of history persisted even to come as a kind of knee-jerk reaction on my own part to the Charlottesville massacre, Charlottesville demonstrations. And so then I was invited to do these lectures, and I had finished not long before finished Sex and Secularism, and I thought, I just can't do another book about gender and history. I think I've said everything I needed to say or wanted to say. So, you know, when you have to do a series of lectures, you're supposed to come up with something a little bit different or new. And so I thought, well, what would happen if I took up this notion of the judgment of history and tried to historicize it, look at it not just as a large philosophical concept, because I'm a historian, not a philosopher. Mm-hmm. What would happen? And I had to give three lectures. If I gave three lectures on different cases that illustrated different aspects of what were seen even at the time as delivering the judgment of history. So that was the inspiration. And I started reading and looking around, and I decided on the three cases that I guess we're going to talk about in a few minutes, because they seemed to me both in terms of history, but also in terms of their relevance to the topics, which were fascist Nazism and the Holocaust, apartheid in South Africa, and the ongoing debates about reparations for slavery in the United States. And so those three things were kind of on my mind, and I thought, okay, let me use those as ways of thinking through this question.
And of course, in your past work, you've also reflected on many instances where I think we could say humankind may not have necessarily learned from the lessons of history. I'm looking at your 2007 book, The Politics of the Veil.
Right.
Did you in any way draw on any of your previous work or your previous books to come to the conclusions you reached in these lectures?
I think only in the sense that I was thinking about, in all of them, I've been thinking about history. I mean, the gender and the politics of history, my collection of that early collection of essays, which is still very much in print and very much read, and is also a Columbia University Press book like this one is.
Yeah.
I always thought of the challenge of feminism and feminist history as having to speak not only to the story of women in the past, but to the way in which history for so long, or historians for so long, ignored women, the way in which women were thought not to be so much agents of history compared to what men could achieve in politics and other areas. So I think I've thought for a long time about the relationship of whatever it is I was working on to something we could call history in the more theoretical or philosophical sense. So in that sense, there's a connection. But you know, people who are used to reading me for gender are not going to find it in this book. I mean, I feel apologetic about that. And on the other hand, it just was the moment that I was asked to do this, at having finished one book on, which is full of questions about gender and sexuality. I just felt like I needed to think about something else in a hard way that I hadn't thought about in the same way before.
Yeah, sure. And you did say you started thinking about this question in 2017. Now, 3 years between 2017 and now isn't a particularly long period of time, not at least for a historian. But nonetheless, I was wondering how your position and how your beliefs might have evolved in those 3 years from when you first started thinking about this issue to now.
That's a really interesting question, because when I gave the lectures at Columbia, a lot of the people in the audience pressed me very hard about what my own view of history was. Did I think that, if not, that history would redeem us in the end? Did I think that we needed to think that it was possible to have a better future in order to mobilize politically? What was the relationship between my views of history and my views of politics? And I guess, if anything, I feel more convinced now about what I say at the very end of the book in the epilogue, mm-hmm. that if we've given up on the idea of history as redemptive, doesn't mean giving up on the idea of changing things in the present. We can't guarantee the future, but we have to act to bring it about. There's no guarantee that we will. we can't even convince ourselves that we are on the good side of history. You know, in these debates right now that are going on, mm-hmm. about Trump and Biden and all of the rest, and almost every day somebody says something about, well, history will be the judge of what they say. History will be the judge of these actions. In the end, history will look back on this moment, yeah. and see how terrible it was. If you don't believe that, which I don't, then what is it that can move you to act? And what I say at the end of the book is that we almost have no other choice. That is that refusing to accept conditions that seem to us unequal, impossible, in the case of democracies, anti-democratic or authoritarian, refusing to accept all of that does not mean that we know that a better future is possible, but But it does mean that we have to act to make it happen, to act as if we could bring that about. So I guess I feel that in the face of what often feels like great despair right now, I don't know if you guys listened to the debate last night, but despair doesn't seem to me to be an option, even as I feel worried and despairing about the conditions that exist now. So my sense is that one has to try to make history, even if history is not going to cooperate with, it doesn't promise us that if we act in its name, we will bring about the desired ends.
That's a wonderful way of thinking about things. And it does bring us very helpfully to the content of your book. And you mentioned earlier the popular appeal of these calls for history to be the judge. We see this idea of history being the final judge of one's actions being thrown around very often. And mm-hmm. without, this is a very compelling idea, to quote Theodore Parker, as you do in your book, that the arc of the moral universe, while long, somehow bends towards justice. Why do you think such appeals to history as the final arbiter of truth are so common and so popular?
Well, partly I think it comes from a 19th century vision of history, a philosophical notion of history as an inevitably progressive movement through time. Mm-hmm. One that has as its telos, as some people have written, the nation state itself. So what comes into existence with the nation state, with the modern Western nation state, is a vision of history as necessarily progressive, moving towards better and better and better things in the future, with the state as the kind of embodiment of the possibilities that the progressive future offers. And I think that vision is deeply rooted, at least in Western societies, and very hard to get rid of. You know, it's sort of, even as sometime in the 20th century, probably in post-World War II period, there is, many people have written about this, a loss of belief in a master narrative of history, that it's inevitably progressive and it's going to take us to the promised land, whether it's a secular promised land or a religious one. That notion sort of resides still in popular consciousness, even in the consciousness of historians. I mean, yeah. Myself included, that's how I started thinking about this this project. So I think that's some of it, is that it's there to be drawn on and looked to in popular consciousness as an idea that we can aspire to or believe in. I also think that it has a kind of consoling quality to it. That is, when things are really terrible, it's enormously consoling to think that, you know, even if not in my lifetime, in the lifetime of my grandchildren, things will be better. And if I continue to act the way I've been acting and engage in the political work that I've engaged in, then I will help bring about that future. And so I think that fantasy, and it is a fantasy, operates as a consoling thing in moments like this, when despair is the other alternative. You know, when you look at, I think I quoted in the book, I think it's Max Horkheimer, and he's writing in 1934. So he says, when you're at the lowest ebb, when you are at the lowest ebb, exposed to an eternity of torment inflicted upon you by other human beings, you cherish as a dream of deliverance the idea that a being will come who will stand in the light and bring truth and justice for you. You don't even need this to happen in your lifetime, nor in the lifetime of those who are torturing you to death. But one day, whenever it comes, all will nonetheless be repaired. It is bitter to be misunderstood and to die in obscurity. It is to the honor of historical research that it projects light into that obscurity. And it's interesting that rereading the Horkheimer, Adorno, Benjamin, Frankfurt School philosophers whom I had read before, in this context right now, now, I understand them better than I think I ever did, because I not only philosophically can gather what it is they're trying to say, but I feel as if I'm living in a similar moment. For them, the 1934 is when he writes that. The image of fascism ascendant leads him to write in those terms as the others. You know, they're all looking around and saying, how could this have happened? We never expected this to be what would follow from the triumph of the Weimar Republic or the Russian Revolution or, you know, whatever these major events that seem to be bringing about a different future. How could it happen that it was all falling apart? And it feels the same for me, who my most sort of politically active moments were in the 60s and 70s when I was in college and graduate school, and when everything seemed possible, you know, when it seemed like we were creating a better future. So the notion of the kind of consoling vision, an ultimate historical judgment, I think continues to be very powerful.
Well, I suppose then in many ways, fantastical as the idea of using history as the arbiter of truth may be, it's something that we don't just rely on, but I think it might be an indispensable idea to all of humankind. Would you say that?
I don't know about all of humankind, because I do think that this vision of history is a modern Western concept to start with. How it gets disseminated and absorbed and elsewhere in the world is I don't know. But I feel most comfortable talking about it within its historical limits, that is as a product of the 18th and 19th centuries, and as somehow as a product of the 18th and 19th centuries, and therefore deeply rooted in the ways, the popular ways of thinking about time and history and events. But I don't think I would make it a claim. It's one of the things I think I'd criticize about Hegel, is that he does make it a universal claim.
Well, I think that brings us very nicely to the content of your book. You alluded to this earlier, the concept of the nation state being the tailors of history. Now, your book comprises three chapters, each expounding on a different interpretation of the judgment of history. Let's start with the first chapter, which is the Nuremberg trials and what that tells us about the nation state being, you know, the culmination of everything in history. Could you walk us through that case study?
Sure. The interesting thing about the Nuremberg Tribunal, reading it from the vantage with my set of questions about the judgment of history, was how clearly the head of the tribunal, Justice Jackson, who was an associate justice of the Supreme Court, articulates that we are here, basically, he says, to deliver the judgment of history. That is to condemn Nazism to the past, to look at the horror created by those who took over the German state, the criminals who took over the German state. And the point of the tribunal is to make sure that this will never happen again, to remind us of what could happen if these excesses came about, and to prevent them from ever coming again. So the idea was that you both would look at this history, and on the other hand, you would be able to consign what had happened to the dustbin of history. And what I argue is, of course, the notion of the moral judgment had to do with a victory in war, that it was the Allied forces defeated Nazis, and that was, in a sense, the proof of the judgment of history. It was their victory brought about their ability to make that judgment, but it was its own judgment. That, to me, was the way in which the problem of the nation state and the nation state as resting on a certain form of ethno-nationalism, which was common to all of the Allied powers at the end of the war has to be protected against Nazis, so that the Nazi state becomes an exception to what normal states actually do. Mm-hmm. Normal, the Russians are there, so it's not a democratic state, but normal modern states can do. And there are all these moments, and I was very struck by this when read the materials, when Jackson says, well, if the Nazis hadn't engaged in aggressive warfare, war is okay to engage in, but aggressive warfare in which they were attacking other nations, if they hadn't engaged in aggressive warfare, we wouldn't be able to make these judgments. Yeah. Because the internal affairs of any nation are up to that nation. Other nations cannot intervene. We in the United States have our problems with minorities. And this is a period in which lynching is continuing to go on in the South against African Americans. And he says, in fact, if the Nazis' treatment of the Jews had just been a domestic problem, we wouldn't have, horrible as that was, we wouldn't have been able to intervene there either. But since it was preparation for what they would then go on to do in Poland, other parts of the world, we could intervene because it became a matter of international concern rather than national concern. So the double sort of thing of protecting a certain image of nation state on the one hand, and casting Germany outside the pale of what counted as a nation either, is very much what seems to me to go on at Nuremberg. And that's sort of part of my argument, is that he have a tribunal of nation states delivering a judgment of history, but leaving in place what some of us, and Hannah Arendt is one of the people I cite in this, yeah, look at as the problem of nation states, which is ethnonism, the notion that you have a homogeneous population based on language or race or religion or you know, something that defines us and them, that is left in place. And you know, for my initial question, whatever happened to the judgment of history, the answer in that chapter is the failure to define what in fact was probably one of the sources of the Nazi excesses leaves in place the possibility for those kinds of problems to arise again. The mistreatment of minorities, the kind of racist behavior of the very nation states that were involved in making the judgment of history. So that chapter, as the next chapter, are both interested in looking at what the limits are in the delivery of the judgment of history that open the possibilities for less than the perfect future arrive, if not to leave in place the very elements that were partly responsible for what happened in the situation that was supposed to have been closed off or foreclosed as something that could never happen again.
Well, it seems to me that a major flaw of the system of this judgment of history as enacted at Nuremberg wasn't just the assumption that the nation state is, you know, as you say, the telos of history, but also the fact that the people enacting this judgment were political actors with vested interests and people who are part of the state apparatus. I'm wondering if you think that historians, supposedly impartial and apolitical, would be in some ways better actors than political ones in enacting history's judgment?
I don't know. that's a really good question. Do I trust historians more than I trust politicians? I don't know. I'm not sure that there aren't as many disagreements among historians about, in fact, what happened at Nuremberg as there was or would be among political figures. I I just don't know. I think my answer would be that historians probably aren't in the best position to make policy. because once you're in that position, you don't have the distance on it that those of us who do history are supposed to have. That is, when you're in a situation in which you have to make practical, pragmatic decisions, yeah. You behave differently from the way you would if you're looking at this material, as I did, with a kind of critical, a long-term critical distance.
Sure.
And that, you know, that would also suggest that there are lessons of history to actually be learned. And I'm not sure that we ever learn from the lessons of history.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, let's talk about the nation state as a tales of history, which was the overarching theme in the first chapter. I get the sense that the ramifications of this assumption extend well beyond the realm of just historical judgment, because very often we see the idea of the nation state being superimposed on many of our understandings of history. If you look at, for instance, medieval societies and polities, there's a tendency to implicitly assume that these polities constituted early attempts at state formation when perhaps they did not. So do you think the assumption that the nation state is the telos of history fundamentally threatens not just what it means to render history's judgment, but more broadly, what it means to study history as an academic field?
Yeah, I think it does, absolutely. Because it limits, what it does is it leads you to accept the linear notion of history that whose telos is the nation state. There's a historian called Massimiliano Tomba, who's writing a lot about history and temporality. And he's somebody you should interview in these things. He has a book that's called, Insurgent Universality, which came out last year. I think it's Oxford University Press. And what he argues is that, in fact, it's the nation state that needs to create this coherent, singular line of development, which cancels out all of the complexity as history happens. The fact that there are other groups contesting the form that that political organization should take, that are looking for alternative ways of organizing politically, and that these are left out or deliberately obscured if the story that we tell is basically the story of the emergence of nation states and then their political interactions internationally and otherwise, the actions of people within the nation against even resisting or against the nation. But the nation, if the nation is the focus of the whole thing, you're basically left with a singular temporality that is linear and probably usually progressive, that doesn't leave room for seeing how, in fact, history is a much more complex set of conflicts and their resolutions over time.
Mm-hmm. And do you see this assumption of the nation state being so central to understanding of history as part of a broader trend in which we take operative categories that we have in the present and we apply them to understandings of the past when they may not necessarily fit? Do you think it's a worrying trend in this respect?
I actually think the trend is in the other direction. I think the trend has been away from a concentration on political history to other forms of history, cultural history, social history, and so on. I think in the last maybe 15 or 20 years, there's been and part of that is the challenge of women's historians, historians of African American life or of slavery, of colonialism. I mean, I think there's been something of a move away from the assumption that the nation state is the place that carries history forward. Although there still certainly are beliefs that if you don't have a nation state, you aren't part of history. I mean, I think the Israel-Palestine conflict has been analyzed in part in those terms, that the desperate reason for a Palestinian state is that you don't count as historical actors if you don't have a state of your own. So it's there, you know, it's there as part of the discourse, but as the focus of historians, I think the state and politics has been sort of pushed to the side in order to bring in other kinds of concerns and other interests. I mean, the interesting thing, and we can skip in this to the last chapter for a minute, is the movement for reparations for slavery is one that calls into question the ability of the nation state to deliver on the promise of justice. Yeah. And what one after another of the people who are advocating reparations say is, look, there was the end of slavery, and then there was Reconstruction, and then there was the taking back of Reconstruction, and then there was this Brown versus Board of Education and the integration of schools, but at the same time the redlining of districts in neighborhoods so that segregation became the definition, or segregation of African American populations became a new form of separation and discrimination. And you know, last week Trump issued another of his, I think of them now as faux executive orders, but another executive order in which he says, you know, the teaching of history is racist if it tries to blame another group for the oppression of a group. So if you say that white supremacy has been part of the problem of discrimination against blacks in America, you are racist because you're discriminating against whites as a group. I mean, it's this torturous document to read, but it basically says, you know, we've been doing everything right. The arc of justice is, the arc of the universe is slow, or it takes a long time, but we've been delivering justice. And in the 47 years since Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech, we've fulfilled the promise of that dream. Meanwhile, you have Black Lives Matter groups demonstrating in the streets of most American cities. You have the killings of Blacks by police day after day that come to the fore. So, and what the reparations movements are doing is saying, look, there has not been this progress. Indeed, the story of the American nation is a story of a nation founded on slavery. Let's move the timeline from 1776, the Declaration of Independence, to 1619, when the first ship arrives on American shores with slaves in them. And let's talk about the ways in which slavery is foundational to the economic and political development of the United States. And so, you know, what the reparations movements are doing is saying this history, which looked to the nation state to redeem us or to deliver justice, is the antithesis of that. It's a history which has not been realized and will not be until we as a nation take account of the things that it leaves out.
Well, we'll definitely have to get back to this topic of reparations later on in the podcast, because it's a very important part of your book. But I'd like to first set the context of this broader discussion on the judgment of history by looking at the case outlined in your second chapter, which tackles the limits of forgiveness in post-apartheid South Africa. What is the main lesson of this case study?
Well, it's a different story, as the people at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recognized. That is, there was no victory in war. Apartheid ended with a political settlement. As I quote, I think Desmond Tutu says, you know, they still had all the guns. The white right-wing forces, the protectors or defenders of apartheid. So they had to look for a way of reconciling a nation that had been rent by protest, by war, by discrimination, and so on and so forth. And there is, this was fascinating to me because I didn't know it before, there is at the beginning of the idea for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission actually comes from a Gramscian Marxist who, named Kadar Asmal, who says that a commission like that could be cathartic because it would bring to the fore the stories of people who had been victims of apartheid, but they would not be see themselves as victims. They would see themselves as active agents calling to account the past of this country, and thereby being able to activate themselves to bring about a different future. And so that's his vision of it. But Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Archbishop, becomes the head of the commission. Yeah. And his vision of what the commission is to accomplish is a different kind of catharsis, the catharsis of forgiveness, that the victims of apartheid could come forward and tell what had happened to them, recount what had happened to them, and in some way or another forgive what had happened in order to launch a new future. And that notion of forgiveness, which is a much more Christian, passive one, yeah, is the one that that prevails in the commission's deliberations. And what the commission doesn't deliver, and here again my interest in how things continue after the end is supposed to happen, what they never really are able to confront are the structural conditions upon which the apartheid system was based. They do confront some of the political ones, some of the ways in which laws, past laws and other kinds of laws prevented the free movement of labor, the enslavement, if not the enslavement, the indenturement and the indebtedness of workers, of African workers. But what they don't sort of come up with is, I think, a critique of the property system upon which much of the system was based, so that, for example, land, well, whites are able to keep their land and their property. The great proportion of wealth of South Africa is still in the hands of white landowners or white capitalists. And so establishing a black majority for the political nation does not address the underlying economic conditions which held inequality in place. And that in part has to do with, I think, there's no victory in war, and so there's a negotiated settlement that actually leaves in power a great deal of if not in political power, in economic power, a great deal of the wealth that had already been established. So there, you know, the great promise of Nelson Mandela and of the Rainbow Nation doesn't come into effect. Yes, apartheid is set to rest. Apartheid will not come back in the form that it was. But the limits of the solution, the limits of the delivery of justice are held in place by a legal and an economic system that perpetuates inequality, I guess, and injustice.
Mm-hmm. And another theme that really underlies this, both the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as well as the Nuremberg Trials, as you said, was this idea that history is linear, that we move only forward. And something that stood out to me in this particular chapter was the metaphor of a bridge. In fact, two metaphors, two different metaphors of how history is likened to a bridge. I think it's a beautiful way of visualizing the different attitudes one could have towards history. Could you tell us a bit more about this metaphor?
Yeah, that's really, it's really interesting. You know, it's one of the things when you're doing this kind of work, things strike you. And I kept seeing this on the part of many of the of Tutu and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. People were saying the commission itself is a bridge to the future. And the notion is that it's a one-way bridge. From the past, the commission is the bridge which allows us to traverse the difficult conditions of a negotiated settlement, but it's going to end us up on the other side. And the other side is the rainbow nation of a non-racial, integrated, liberal democracy. And then there's the image that I use to sort of counter that, which is Michel de Certeau, who says, no, a bridge is not a one-way street. A bridge, you go back and forth across the bridge. A bridge takes you to different places, but then you return. And that struck me as a complicated image of the story I was trying to tell. People cross the bridge, looking to establish various new kinds of things, but they come back to the old place that they were. And in that old place are at once new arrivals and former arrivals, and how you negotiate the traffic across the bridge complicates that linear view of history in really profound ways, I think.
Yeah, and I think talking about the final chapter, which you very kindly overviewed for us earlier, we see again the idea that history isn't just progressive, it isn't just linear, and you have this bridge in history where you're going forward and backward, progressing and regressing at the same time. One thing that has persisted throughout these three narratives, and you talked about the reparations movement earlier, seems to be the persistence of structures of power and their ability to limit our judgment of history, you know, very narrow vision of the judgment of history. Could you say a bit more about these structures of power, what challenges they pose to us, and how we can overcome them?
That's a really big question, yeah. I think I think it's for different reasons, but I guess I would say that those who are entrenched in the structures of power, particularly in the first two cases, or the first case, the political ones, are the ones who try to set the terms of, you know, in all of the debates a month or so ago about the judgment of history on Trump, the Attorney General Bill Barr said, history is written by the victors and we're going to win. And, you know, that's actually what Benjamin says too about has the angel of history kind of, but anyway, we need to go into that. But so there is, I don't think the victors always write history, but I think the notion of power that I would have is that those who are in command, who are politically in control, want to stay that way. And so they will do what they have to accommodate resistance or protest or change. In the first case of the triumphant democracies at the end of World War II, the protection of the notion of the nation state is tremendously important, and the exclusion of the Nazis as not just a perverse example of the nation state, but as outside the realm of what we can think of as acceptable nation, as a barbarian kind of development. There's nothing they had in common with us, even though, as I say in that chapter, colonialism could, the colonial practice of the British in India or the French in the Maghreb, in West Africa, or in could be offered as examples of the problems that attain to certain kinds of organization in the nation state. So, but holding on to power is a tremendously important part of that, and writing the history to conform to those notions is also really important. And so I think in some ways the story of history is the story of powerful groups wanting to hold on to their power, justify it in terms of their fulfillment of some kind of mission of history, and excluding or resisting attempts to impose alternatives or transform the power that they hold. Now, in the case of apartheid, the white supremacist political elite lost, and they were out of power. But the what I argue, I think, is that the underlying economic arrangements, not having been changed, led to problems of a kind that were not fully anticipated by those who welcomed the end of apartheid as the beginning of you know the new era, which would be kind of more more promising and just than the one that had come before.
Well, a strong antithesis to the structures of power that we've just talked about is embodied in the reparations movement, which is essentially an attempt to rewrite history, not from, I think, the victor's perspective or the powerful's perspective. Do you think the reparation movement offers us a useful model for a more inclusive interpretation of history, and hopefully, you know, a more progressive one?
Yes, I do. Progressive might not be the right word, yeah. but a more critical one, I would say. Yes, I think it does, because what it says is, what the reparations movement says is, look, there have been criticisms of slavery from the beginning, and there are all sorts of examples of people demanding reparations long before the end of the Civil War. And the reply has always been less than satisfactory in terms of granting what's being asked for. And so what the nation has incurred is a huge debt. And I think the debt is much symbolic as it is. I mean, it is certainly financial, but it's the symbolic notion of an unpayable as well as unpaid debt of the white nation to its African-American population that is at the heart of the reparations movement. And what that requires is a rewriting of history. Their argument is it's a rewriting of history in which a linear progress is no longer going to be told, but advances and setbacks, a kind of undertow of resistance to the end of inequality and discrimination. And that story has to be faced fully and incorporated into our understanding we are as a people if justice is ultimately to reign. And that means, of course, that the judgment of history is not being delivered by the state. In fact, the state has been incapable of delivering it. But the judgment of history is being delivered by the those who have been left out, who have been refused incorporation. I don't want to call them victims, because the demand for reparations, in fact, is a refusal of the victim status. It's more a redefinition of victims as creditors. You owe us, and we are going to call in the debt. I found that a very powerful way of thinking about the non-victim position that is taken by people who are demanding reparations. Mm-hmm. It's that creditor-debtor relationship that is being insisted upon.
Mm-hmm. And do you think more broadly the reparations movement also blurs the line between what is the past and what is the present? Has it forced us to rethink what exactly entails history, how much of history we can consign to the past and how much we actually live in currently.
Yes, I think it absolutely does. And the notion of the zombie or the undead is one of the ways in which it gets articulated. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think it's in Ta-Nehisi Coates, whom I use a lot, to whose text I on the in favor of reparations, I use a lot in that chapter as a kind of focus of my analysis, who talks of the undead. And in fact, I think what we're getting is a vision of history in which the past continues into the present in ways that inform and challenge and corrupt what stands for a kind of better future. As long as that past is there and unrecognized and unaddressed, it continues to pervert the possibilities for equality and for justice. And I think it is a different vision, the vision of history that says there isn't a linear line of progress. There are all of these different places we have to look to see how powerful groups are sorting out or claiming to represent the next stage of history, to represent the future, but who are as interested in preserving their position, their privilege, as they are in taking us to better times, to a more progressive world.
Yeah. And in fact, you read us a quotation earlier from your book, and I came across, I think, a very apt quotation from Edward Said just the other day that I think encapsulates the spirit of your last two chapters. He said, and I quote, "Appeals to the past are among the commonest of strategies and interpretations of the present. What animates such appeals is not only disagreement about what happened in the past and what the past was, but uncertainty about what the past really is past, over and concluded, or whether it continues, albeit in different forms, perhaps." That's a wonderful line, I think, very relevant to the conversation we're having right now.
Yeah, absolutely perfect. And in fact, did you find that after you read the book, after you read my book?
Yeah, I found it in another book, in fact. And it just struck me because I just finished your book and I started on that book, and you know, I didn't expect to find a quotation that apt.
Because that's what happened to me. I think once you've been alerted to thinking about these questions of time and history and justice and judgment, you find quotes that you might not have noticed before that become suddenly apt and relevant. Actually, it's happened to me since the book was published. There have been a couple of things that I've read and I thought, oh, if only I had read that book, I would have had it in the book as well. So, and that's another example. That Said quote is wonderful. It's another example, exactly the kind of thing I think I was trying to argue.
Well, you mentioned earlier in the podcast that when you were delivering this lecture at Columbia University, many of the questions you got were concerning your own personal opinions about what it means to render history's judgment. And I'm afraid I'll have to ask you a few questions in a similar vein. Now, with respect to rendering history's judgment or dealing with the consequences of history, where do you think we should go from here? What is the logical next step?
I guess I think that there is no such thing as a judgment of history. That what we need to do is say that we're making judgments based on certain ethical or moral principles that we hold. And that those may or may, they may, some of them may have roots in history and in the Enlightenment or in other forms of in other articulations of notions of equality or justice or the ideals we aspire to. But it's what we're involved in as political actors and as social beings is not the enactment of the judgment of history, but the attempt to realize certain moral and ethical principles that guide the actions that we take.
And having spent so much of your career studying the past and a good part of the last 3 years looking at, you know, this concept of history's judgment, Are you in any way optimistic or pessimistic about the future of humanity?
Well, I grew up in a family in which despair was not an option. So I feel as if the legacy of my own upbringing won't let me despair. But I feel like we're at a moment now where it's very hard to be optimistic. And I think my sense is that the necessity to act in the name of one's ethical principles, rather than a belief that an inevitable better future is coming, is the ground on which I act. So I feel like action is necessary to defend these principles, even if I can't say that a better future is inevitably going to arrive. I want a better future to happen. But I think I'm both enough of a student of history and in the moment, a political person terribly anxious about what the next months in the United States are going to bring, to feel like there's any guarantee.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you mentioned about your role, not just as a student of history, but also someone who is deeply interested in the politics of your time. Do you find it difficult to strike a balance between being that dispassionate academic who's supposed to distance herself from her work and standing up for values that you truly believe in?
I don't think there's a distinction between those two. I think the reason I do the work I do is because of the values I truly believe in. It doesn't mean that I write history as a kind of to prove my beliefs, but I think of myself as a critical historian. And I think that what I mean by critical history is looking at the ways in which things that are taken to be common sense or taken for granted need to be interrogated, need to be questioned. So my work on gender, for example, is an example of that. You know, the common sense notions of what it meant to be man or woman need to be called into question and asked how they became common sense notions. The notion of the judgment of history that inspires these essays is the question of how the judgment of history comes to be understood as a form of consolation, but also how it worked to, in fact, preclude the very promise that it offered, the sort of contradiction of a judgment of history that at the same time is a politically calculated attempt to protect something or protect privilege in a way that that maintains and continues it. So I don't know. There's a thing I quote from Foucault in there, in which I say, I guess the position that seems most closest to my own right now is less one that says the future, we're creating a better future, than the one that says I don't want to be governed like that. You know, that there's a form of government under which we're living now, ways of organizing life, that are not the ones by which I want to live. And so that it feels like my position most of all. That is, I don't want to be governed like that. Of course, it means looking to the future because it means saying how I might want to be governed, but it's less future oriented than it is present oriented. So, that is, let's sort of change what we have right now, because it's an unacceptable way of organizing society.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way to end, I think, this segment of the interview. And it does take us to our final question. Mm-hmm. Normally I ask my guests, if they could interview someone for their new book in history, who would that be? And you actually answered it earlier in the interview. You suggested Insurgent Universality by Massimiliano Tomba. Is there any other writer whose work you think is incredibly relevant to the topics we've talked about today?
Yeah, another one, although the book is not out yet, it's just being sort of written. I read the manuscript of it, so I know about it. There's a historian named Gary Wilder who teaches at the Graduate Center at the City University in New York. Yeah. I can't remember what he's calling that book. But it's about the different ways of thinking the future and of thinking the past. And I think that, but another one that is just published in addition to Max Tomba's book is by Fadi Bardawil. And it's called something about disenchantment and revolution, Duke University Press. It's about the ways in which Lebanese socialists who are Marxist Maoists in the 60s and 70s, but who lived through the civil wars and the disenchantment of the 70s and 80s, come to other political positions. It's an incredibly smart and interesting analysis of the trajectory of a group of political leftists from socialism to an increasing engagement with Islamic, not religious particularly, but Islamic philosophy and theory. So sort of from west to east, but it's an extremely, because he writes the history as they're living through these political conflicts. So it's at once how the sort of philosophy or theory is articulated in action and through action, and disenchantment is something of a theme we've been addressing today, and it's a theme that he addresses directly in that book.
Sure. And for listeners who might be interested, the full title is Revolution and Disenchantment, Arab Marxism and the Binds of Emancipation by Fadi A. Bardawil. In fact, Fadi was here on the New Books Network earlier in June to talk about this very book. So if there's one episode you'd like to listen to after this, that should be the one, I suppose.
That's great. I will definitely listen to it. Thank you.
Well, I think we've spent a very good hour talking about a very broad range of topics. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Joan, and you've been a very gracious guest. We'd love to have you on the program again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who's read my book carefully. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, on that note, thank you for your time, and thanks for listening to this episode of New Books in History.